Pregina Celi, Letare, Alleluia.
The first full week of the papacy of Pope Leo XIV, his voice raised in song during the Sunday Regina Caeli, with masses of faithful below in St. Peter's Square, to audiences with important constituencies, including the head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. We take a look at the start of what already appears to be an extraordinary pontificate. Insights from EWTN's senior Vatican analyst.
Seeing just the diversity of places and communities that we're visiting, it's really a testament to the fact that Jesus wants to encounter everyone.
Comments from a perpetual pilgrim who will step off this weekend at the beginning of the 2025 National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Complete coverage from Indianapolis, the starting point of this celebration of the true presence of Christ. EWTN News in Depth starts now. An enthusiastic standing ovation for Pope Leo XIV from journalists, no less, during a papal audience just days into his pontificate. Pope Leo using the very large platform of the Vatican to begin to spread his message of peace and unity to an eager audience across the globe. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. From the moment he stepped out from behind those crimson curtains on St. Peter's Loggia just over 1 week ago, Pope Leo has hit the ground running. He is keeping a hectic pace of religious services, audiences, meetings, consultations, and more. We look at the first few days of his papacy and what it might signal about how he plans to lead.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
In our first impression of our new Holy Father, Pope Leo XIV broke precedence by arriving to the St. Peter's Loggia prepared with paper in hand.
Fratelli, sorelle, carissimi.
Reading from written remarks as his election was announced to the world, the earliest indicator our new pontiff moves with intention and also with speed, his first week filled with activity.
I want to repeat the words from the responsorial psalm, I will sing a new song to the Lord because he has done marvels.
Last Friday at the Sistine Chapel, in his first Mass as Pope, Leo once again appeared prepared. Father Robert Hagen, an Augustinian priest at the Pope's alma mater, Villanova University, has known Pope Leo for nearly 30 years.
This is a big job, but it's not his first leadership position. He was a math major. And he's also a canon lawyer, so he's a logical thinker, and so he expresses himself with great clarity. I think the flock will appreciate the way he speaks and he writes, because it comes across in a very intelligible, relatable way.
While his papacy is enjoying its honeymoon phase, our new pope's schedule made clear this past weekend, the pontificate is no vacation.
Il ritorno al primato di Cristo.
On Saturday, Leo laid out his vision to the College of Cardinals, emphasizing a commitment to church social teaching in our AI age. He whisked off for his first trip outside of the Vatican, visiting the Augustinian run, the Shrine of the Mother of Good Counsel, carving out space on his calendar for Our Lady. The Pope also paid his respects to his predecessor, visiting the tomb of Pope Francis at St. Mary Major. His day of rest also had a to-do list. Following Mass at St. Peter's tomb, Pope Leo then gave a Regina Caeli address with a surprise in song form.
Letare, alleluia.
He appealed to the faithful for peace in Ukraine and then directly appealed to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky about it in a private phone call. Vatican watchers are noticing the spry 69-year-old's calendar so far and what it may signal.
I think the mathematician in him is really coming out. Everything's ordered. Everything's logical. There's a reason behind everything that he's doing. All of it seems to be well thought out. And to me, I'm somewhat amazed. It's almost as if he's known for 69 years he would be the Holy Father, because he's ahead of almost all of the decisions that a true novice would confront.
I think we can say that so far Pope Leo knows how to pope.
Former U.S. ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Rooney, knew Pope Leo for years while he was in Rome. He's expecting nothing less than strong governance from our pontiff.
When he became head of all the Augustinians was when we moved to Rome for the ambassador job, and we saw an awful lot of him there. He did a great job running the order. You know, the Augustinian order hasn't had many of the problems that some other orders have had, because I think I attribute it to good management, like Father Bob.
These first few days in the Petrine office have also included a meeting with the media, the relaunch of the papal social media, an audience with pro tennis player Yannick Sinner at the Vatican, a message to Eastern Catholics, among other agenda items. It's a first week on the job you might expect from someone with an American work ethic, enhanced by a worldwide resume.
They say when they clap at the beginning, it doesn't matter much. If you're still awake at the end and you still want to applaud, thank you very much.
The inaugural Mass for Pope Leo XIV will happen this Sunday. It will be broadcast in full on EWTN live at 3 a.m. Eastern time, with a rebroadcast at 12 noon Eastern. The delegation representing the United States will include Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, both of whom are Catholic. For his insights on this first full week of Pope Leo's papacy, we turn to EWTN senior Vatican analyst Frank Rocha. He joins us now near St. Peter's Square. Frank, Pope Leo seems to come prepared and to be clear. That being said, what are some themes that have come up in his comments as Pope so far? What clues is he giving the faithful on how he might lead and prioritize issues?
Well, he told us that he chose his name in honor, above all, of Pope Leo XIII, who wrote the famous encyclical Rerum Novarum, responding to the challenges of the Industrial Revolution. Pope Leo XIV says he wants to do something similar for the challenge of AI, and that it poses to work and the economy today. So that's one, clearly one priority. Today he met the diplomats, diplomatic corps accredited to the Holy See, and he made a comment that has gotten a lot of attention. He said that the family, it's important to defend the family, which is based on the stable union of a man and a woman, which of course is traditional Catholic teaching, but is of course a controversial position today. And so he underscored that.
Frank, you actually met and interviewed our Pope back in 2012 when he was then Father Robert Prevost, prior general of the Order of St. Augustine. Tell us what he was like and any insight that interview gave you into the man that he is.
Well, that interview was prompted because in 2012, that was still in the pontificate of Benedict XVI, then Father Prevost, who was the prior general of the Order of St. Augustine, gave an intervention at the Synod on the new evangelization. And he spoke very strongly, very quotably, very provocatively about the challenge of the Western mass media promoting what he called anti-Christian lifestyle choices, including abortion, euthanasia, but also same-sex marriage and same-sex adoption. So we interviewed him. I was then with the Catholic News Service, another outlet, and we also talked about St. Augustine, and we talked about how the church and Catholic media can reach people, can evangelize. It was a wide-ranging discussion. He was very gracious. He was very clear. He argues in a very clear, methodical way. He's very approachable. You can see the video. It's and it gives us a sense of his character and also of his thinking. Mm.
Frank, the first U.S.-born pope notably did not speak English when he was announced as pope, and yet we have heard Pope Leo sprinkle in his English at times, including at his first Mass. Is this significant? What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's interesting. Yes, and when he came out on the loggia, he switched into Spanish and he made a greeting to his former flock in Chiclayo, Peru, which he's a dual citizen. He's from Chicago. He's an American citizen, but he's also a Peruvian citizen. And so he chose to identify himself to the world as a former Peruvian bishop. He used English for the first time publicly as Pope the next day, talking to the College of Cardinals. And I think that was clearly to reach cardinals who don't speak Italian, who are probably the majority at this point in a very geographic geographically diverse group. You know, today, when he's speaking to the diplomats, he called himself the descendant of immigrants who in turn chose to emigrate, which is an interesting way of putting it. So I think he's certainly American. He's not denying that at all. But I think he's also casting himself as an international figure, and particularly with strong Latin American identity. And I think that's interesting and probably a good idea in the world political scene.
Frank, Pope Leo held an audience with the media earlier this weekend in a now viral exchange when one reporter asked Pope Leo if he had any message for the United States. The Holy Father answered, many. There's no telling exactly what he meant by that, but what do you think, Frank, an American pope could mean for the church in America, for American politics and American society?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, he until he took down his pre-papal account on X, his social media account, we saw the kind of things he was retweeting. He was, in fact, retweeting some messages from Catholic News Agency and from our sister outlet. So about pro-life messages, that was interesting. He also retweeted from other outlets, Catholic outlets, the National Catholic Reporter, some things that were critical of the Trump administration's views on migration. So that array of positions is not particularly surprising. What I think will be interesting, and in fact is in continuity with Pope Francis, what I think is interesting will be that coming as an American who we know that one of his brothers is a strong Trump supporter, outspoken, is that he will have a special insight and even sympathy, I would say, for the people he's in dialogue with. Even if he wants to, for example, make an argument against the Trump administration's policies on migration, I think he will do it with a special understanding of where people are coming from. Many Americans support that policy, so I don't think he's just going to wag his finger at them.
Frank, Pope Leo surprised us all when he sang in Latin during the Regina Celli address on Sunday. Anything we should glean from how good his Latin is?
Well, I'm not myself good enough Latinist to give you the judge of the Latin, but the singing voice was very welcome. Pope Francis, by his own admission, was tone deaf, and he didn't sing in public. Benedict occasionally did, although not in my recollection of the Regina Celli. But so it's interesting to have a singing pope again. I think that's just a personal touch. He certainly has used Latin more than his predecessor already. At the meeting with the media on Monday, he blessed the journalists in Latin. Pope Francis famously didn't bless them at all audibly. He said, I know that some of you are not Catholic, so I'm going to give you a silent blessing. So that was another switch from Pope Francis to Pope Leo, who seems to be a bit more traditional.
Frank, looking back now at Pope Leo's first week, what's been your assessment of how he's led the church, you know, these first few days? And can you even compare to how that has been compared to other modern day popes?
Well, I think again the comparison with Francis is clear. People have been keeping track of, for example, this Pope Leo is expected to go live in the Apostolic Palace in the Papal Apartments, which is the traditional residence for popes. Pope Francis, as you know, famously lived in the Vatican guest house, so that's already another difference. Pope Leo wore the traditional mozzetta cape when he came out on the loggia. Pope Francis didn't do that. But we can also see, for example, and this is, again, another personal issue, but Pope Leo, being relatively young, is an athletic pope. He plays tennis. He worked out at a local gym in Rome. And it's not since John Paul II that we had a truly athletic pope. As we remember, he used to ski and swim. So that's another similarity with the past.
Thanks. And we're seeing photos now of Pope Leo when he was riding horses, for example. Frank Rocha, thank you so much for your reporting and for your insight. It's hard to imagine a more positive reaction to Cardinal Robert Prevost's ascension to the chair of St. Peter than that of the people of Peru. As a missionary priest, then bishop, Prevost spent decades of his life ministering to the faithful in one of the poorest areas of Peru, where he is much beloved. And as Frank just said, he now holds dual citizenship in the U.S. and in Peru. What impact will his ministry there have on Pope Leo's papacy? Eddie Rodriguez-Morel, lead anchor of EWTN's Spanish language newscast, EWTN Noticias, reports from Peru.
In the hot city of Chiclayo, known as the Friendship Capital in northern Peru, Pope Leo XIV carried out his mission as bishop for 8 years between 2015 and 2023.
I belong to the liturgy group in my chapel, and we also belong to a group to help those who come from outside, the migrants and the people. So he was very happy with us. I have a picture with him. I had the joy of taking a picture with him.
We've received the news with great joy, with great pride. He was a promoter of my school, and we young people are very happy and proud that our bishop has been chosen. A surprise, an immense joy, not just for Chiclayo, but also for the whole world. Being that he was here for a long time, he was here for almost 10 years in our Diocese of Chiclayo, the thrill is three or four times as great.
In Chiclayo, current Pope Leo XIV lived as one among his people through several crises that the local government could not manage adequately. Among them were severe floods during the torrential rainy seasons, to which, as a priest and then as bishop, he brought aid to the victims through Caritas, a church aid organization, as a member of its board of directors. He also responded to the COVID pandemic in 2020, managing the purchase of two medical oxygen plants for the sick, which was scarce in the country at the time. In Saña, a few kilometers south of Chiclayo, 300 children attend a school promoted by then-Bishop Prevost in 2017. On a tour of his diocese, the future pope saw two children on the road who were walking to another town to attend school. As a result, he decided to promote this school, which he named St. Nicholas of Tolentino, the first saint of the Order of St. Augustine.
Lo queremos!
¡Sí, el Papa!
In Trujillo, another northern city, his evangelizing zeal also led him to build two churches for which the people are very grateful.
We know Father Robert Prevost. He is very close to us. My mother, my father, and my brothers, we all came to take care of the parish house in 1990, which is right there. The first Augustinian priests arrived there. One of them was Father Robert Prevost. He was the first parish priest and did great work in the whole Montserrat area in those years.
Father Robert Prevost was 30 years old when he first arrived in Peru from the United States in 1985. The humble town of Chulucanas, a land of mangoes and lemons, was the starting ground of the young missionary priest. This territory of intense heat put to the test all the abilities and gifts of the newly ordained Augustinian. Hernanis Diaz, prior provincial of the Order of St. Augustine in Peru, explains how the experiences in Peru forged the priest, bishop, and now pope.
Lo primero que surge es el idioma.
The first thing that comes up is the language, an important challenge to one entering into the dynamics of a slightly different culture, as well as the customs, the very popular religiosity of our people, not only from the Andean region, but also the coastal region and all of Peru.
His Augustinian brother also highlights that this contact with reality helped him to identify the needs of the church.
Pope Leo XIV, while still a young priest, was able to understand the reality, to grasp in one way or another the idiosyncrasies of the people, and above all, to know that he had to bring Christ, which is the main and essential thing.
Throughout his ministry in Peru, Robert Prevost has faced everything, including an accusation of alleged negligence in a canonical investigation of an alleged case of sexual abuse by a priest of his diocese. The current bishop of Chiclayo defends the ongoing process.
He has appeared in the media accusing the cardinal of doing nothing. That is a lie. He has listened, he has respected the processes, and this process is still going on.
This is how the almost 40 years of the life of Robert Prevost, today Pope, were spent in Peru between joys and sorrows shared with the people, preparing him to guide and better bring the gospel, especially to those who are far from God.
To discuss more on the impact of Peru on the Pope's view of the world, Eddie Rodriguez-Morel joins us from the EWTN Noticias newsroom in Lima, Peru. Eddie, this report really helps to put Pope Leo's connection to Peru in perspective for us. So though Pope Leo was born in the United States, watching your story, it seems as if the people of Peru have really embraced him as a native son. What special quality, Eddie, of the Peruvian people do you think Pope Leo will be taking with him into his pontificate?
We have such a rich country in terms of, you know, different cultures within the country. And the north of Peru, specifically Chiclayo, is known as the friendship capital of Peru. And this is for a reason, right? Not just they don't just call themselves that. Everybody else knows them as that because they're very warm, friendly people. They have great faith. And I think that would be just like an ideal, let's say, environment for a priest to start their ministry, right? So, and he has done that. But I also know the community of the Augustinians here in Peru because I used to teach at the theological faculty. And I remember that they were, I mean, they stood out for being very, how would you say, warm, loving, open. And also something that impressed me about them is the fact that as students, they were very interested in truth. Truth was like important to them. And they would just like go into the topics. And at the same time, they were very warm and they were very contemplative. They had a lot of silence among them. I think you can only guess that that's probably has something to do with the fact that they had as a formator for years also here in Peru, in the province, they had also a Father Prevost.
Truth-seeking and friendly. That's a great combination. Eddie,
yes.
What's the word within the Catholic hierarchy of Peru? Any information yet about when Pope Leo will make his first visit back to his beloved home in Peru?
Nothing official yet. We haven't heard anything even. I mean, of course, everybody's waiting for that, and we expect that that will happen soon, but there is no official word yet.
All right, that's the word. From Lima, Peru, Eddie Rodriguez-Morel, lead anchor of the EWTN Spanish language newscast, EWTN Noticias. Thank you so much for your report and for your insights, Eddie.
Thank you so much for being here, for having me.
There is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Reaction from the Ukrainian faithful to Pope Leo's strong message of peace and immediate show of support for the war-torn country.
Our salvation happens through the cross. And right now, Ukraine is crucified.
The head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church in America speaks to Armance Alvarado in St. Peter's Square. And later,
what do young Catholics think of the first U.S.-born pope? I'm Marcel Reyes here at the Bash event at Bishop O'Connell High School in Arlington, Virginia. Their thoughts on Pope Leo XIV coming up next.
Expected peace talks on Thursday between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky fell apart after Putin refused to show up. It would have been the first time the two leaders spoke face-to-face since 2019. A frustrated Zelensky arrived in Turkey's capital on Thursday. Many speculated for days whether the Russian president, who first suggested the direct talks, would come to the negotiating table. Instead, the Kremlin sent a lower-level delegation in his place. Zelensky criticized Russia of not taking negotiations seriously and called the officials a theater prop. On Friday, direct talks still took place between Russia and Ukraine's delegations in Turkey, the first to take place in more than 3 years. During those talks, they agreed to each exchange 1,000 prisoners of war in the near future. From the very start of his papacy, Pope Leo has expressed his support of Ukraine and used his first Regina Caeli address to call for lasting peace in the country. Shortly after that appeal, he spoke with Zelensky over the phone on Sunday, his first known call with a world leader since becoming pope. The two spoke about the thousands of Ukrainian children deported by Russia and how to bring them home. Zelensky said their conversation was a very warm and truly substantive one and invited Leo to make an apostolic visit to his war-torn country. The president will travel to Rome for Pope Leo's inaugural Mass this Sunday. The head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church received a roar of applause on Wednesday as he met Pope Leo XIV. His Beatitude Sviatoslav Shevchuk, Archbishop of Kyiv, greeted the pontiff during his audience for the Jubilee of Eastern Churches, where the Holy Father reiterated his call to end war and violence. In a video message from earlier in the week, his Beatitude shared his hope that Leo will be a pope of peace for Ukraine.
For us Ukrainians, the words Pope for Peace resonate deeply. We are a people who perhaps more than any other today pray fervently for a just and lasting peace, a peace that will allow us to live freely, to flourish, and to breathe the life-giving air of our risen Savior.
On Thursday morning, his Beatitude Shevchuk met Pope Leo in a private audience. There, he gave the Pope a painting called Requiem Prayer. The artwork was painted by a father whose son died as a soldier in the war and represents the suffering of the Ukrainian people. To share more of the voice of the faithful in Ukraine, the EWTN team at the Vatican talked to Archbishop Boris Gudziak, Archbishop of the Ukrainian Catholic Archeparchy of Philadelphia. He was in Rome for the Jubilee of the Eastern Churches and spoke to Armanze Alvarado on Wednesday, the day he met the Holy Father.
Your Grace, it's a pleasure to be here with you in St. Peter's Square when you've just come out of this meeting with the Holy Father as part of the Jubilee of the Eastern Churches. Before I ask you about that, in the meeting that the Holy Father had with journalists, he mentioned those who have fallen in war. Can you tell us about the journalists who have tried to get the story of Ukraine out and not made it out?
Well, Ukraine has been the story, one of the stories of the last years, and it is brought out by journalists who risk their lives to show the truth, to show what people are suffering, to show the evil of war, but also the valor of those who protect the innocent. And no one knows exactly right now, but about 20 journalists have given their lives in covering this war.
What was it like meeting the Holy Father, Pope Leo XIV?
All of us met him for the first time. I think we were all touched from the very moment he appeared on the balcony. He's a very kind man, a sensitive man, very sensible and careful with words. He's somebody that has touched Ukrainians from day one. On Sunday, when he spoke to the city and the world, would be at Orbi, he told the Ukrainians that you are close, you are in my heart. I hold you in my heart, you suffering people. I will work and pray for a just peace, a peace that is lasting. And I will work to free prisoners and the tens of thousands of children that were abducted by the Russians. I think it was that very day that he had a conversation with President Zelensky, who apparently was the first head of state that he had an official conversation with. The president invited him to come and visit Ukraine, to be with the people. Today we heard beautiful words of encouragement, starting with the resurrection. There are wars, there are struggles, there is rhetoric of hatred. Billions of dollars spent to grab power, to own it. Me, I will win, I will control. Often trampling people, thousands and sometimes millions of people are killed in this quest for power. And our body of Christ, the church, the 1.4 billion Catholics, witnessed how their leadership passed from one pope to another with grace and prayer, with great expectation and joy. That is the kingdom of God on earth.
And he served on the dicastery for the Eastern Catholic Churches. What would you say is that primary point? Is it that they're not well known enough, or that there are issues within the churches to keep the faithful as well, similar struggles to the Latin Rite?
We all breathe the same air, watch the same, you know, internet, and we have the same basic human challenges. One fact that distinguishes the Eastern Catholic experience, particularly in modern times, is war, violence, and persecution. Almost all of the Eastern Catholic churches in the Middle East, in North Africa, today in Ukraine, but also in Asia, are suffering from some kind of injustice, some kind of violence. The Holy Father spoke some very strong words, quoting his predecessor, Leo XIII, saying, yes, any Roman Catholic minister that does not respect the Eastern Rites and tries to Latinize the Eastern Christians, bring them into the Latin Church because of disrespect of their own tradition, should cease doing ministry. I mean, that was very strong.
Yes, very direct, very direct. And I think we'll speak into, or gives us a little bit of a clue of what Pope Leo XIV is really looking for in the contribution that he wants the Eastern churches to make to the universal church, but also to young people, for them to really understand the depth of the spirituality that we come from, to understand our roots.
He spoke about that explicitly. He said, with your celebration of the resurrection, with the Christocentric, theocentric way you live, with your fasts, with your traditions, with your monastic legacy, you have something to offer. Hold on to it. It's when you're suffering, when you're small, when you're poor, it's easy to develop an inferiority complex and say, well, we're just going to blend in with the big ones. Today, the Holy Father says, you are the salt of the earth. You are small. You're like the mustard seed. That's what the kingdom is like. It's not size. It's not statistics. It's authenticity. It's sincerity. It's love. It's closeness to Christ. And that is an encouragement that a lot of downtrodden people need to hear. And he expressed it very clearly. He expressed it theologically, but also in a way that I think you could hear the ovations with which people responded to his message.
What kind of leadership do you think will be necessary to be able to bring that peace that Pope Leo spoke about from the Loggia?
It's very important to be clear, to speak the gospel, and to act like Jesus would. Jesus touched those who suffer. The paralytic in Bethesda, who was waiting for 38 years. Today, Ukrainians are waiting. Right now, it is, for us, the beginning of Pope Leo's ministry and of his words has been so encouraging, because he's speaking about a just peace. Because Ukrainians know you can't paper over violence and injustice. You have to name it, and justice must be done. Continuing in that mode, and really what would be incredibly, I think, effective is if the Holy Father ultimately went to visit Ukraine. He went to the place where people are being crucified right now and said, this is the witness of Christ. I am a witness of the resurrection coming to you.
Solving things with witness. Your Grace, thank you for your comments and thank you for your faithfulness.
A resource from EWTN can help you learn more about Pope Leo's life from Chicago to Peru to Rome. A new book by EWTN News editorial director Dr. Matthew Bunsen takes a look at Pope Leo's life and how his papacy could impact Catholics and the world. He explains it's vital to learn about our Catholic leader from a Catholic perspective.
Many of the things that you read or watch in secular media either isn't inaccurate or is sort of a deliberate misrepresentation. So what we want to do with this book is to offer a first portrait of the life, formation, and journey of Robert Francis Prevost from Chicago all the way to Rome, and now, of course, as Pope Leo XIV.
Pope Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope, is available May 21st through EWTN's religious catalog at EWTNRC.com. And while we are not endorsing any of these products, the excitement about Pope Leo is generating all sorts of memorabilia, from baseball trading cards to Pope Leo XIV bobbleheads to tiny saint charms and prayer cards. The National Bobblehead Hall of Fame says the Pope Leo bobblehead quickly became the best-selling of 2025, all an indication that this new pope has certainly captured our attention. Now, back to the serious matters. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. An Israeli-American hostage is released. President Trump gets the royal welcome in the Middle East. And the $400 million jet gifted to the president. Is that going to fly with Congress? We'll be right back. The release of Adon Alexander, the last living American citizen held hostage by Hamas, tops the Week in Review. He is the first hostage to be freed since the Israel and Hamas's ceasefire fell through, sparking hope that stalled negotiations for peace might finally progress. An emotional reunion as a mother embraced a son she feared she would never see again. Adon Alexander, an Israeli-American citizen who grew up in New Jersey and moved to Israel to join its military,
was released on Monday after nearly 600 days in captivity. Hamas abducted Adan and 250 other hostages from Israel on October 7, 2023, igniting a drawn-out and bloody war. He is the latest of many hostages to be freed, but his release is unique. Adan was not exchanged for Palestinian prisoners being held in Israel, but released unconditionally, Hamas reportedly says, as a goodwill gesture toward President Donald Trump. His transfer to the Red Cross was calm and simple, unlike the choreographed and harshly criticized handovers of previous hostages.
So obviously, it would have been maybe counterproductive to have been sadistic and cruel, as we saw on previous occasions, when you're trying to curry favor with the Americans.
In a surprise to Tel Aviv, Hamas and the U.S. held direct talks with mediators in Qatar and Egypt, bypassing Israel. Gaith El-Amari, senior fellow at the Washington Institute, says the U.S. is sending a message to the Middle East.
America first means America first. The U.S. will prioritize U.S. interests, and it's also a message to Israel. The U.S. will do what the U.S. needs to do for its interests. If it works with Israel, great. If it works without informing Israel, also great.
With the release of Adan comes a renewed hope for ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas, though their goals remain at an impasse.
The positions of Israel and Hamas continue to be irreconcilable. Hamas wants a definite end to the war that keeps it in power, while Israel is saying we're not going to accept a situation where Hamas remains in power.
EWTN News contributor Alberto Fernandez says the question is not if this conflict will end, but how it will end.
The question now is the maneuvering by the parties, the Israelis, Hamas, other Palestinians, Arab powers, the United States, about how the end game is played. Israel clearly won militarily in terms of the punishment it was able to inflict on Hamas, but that doesn't mean that that is the way the end of the war or this war is going to end. We still don't know.
58 hostages remain in Gaza, including at least 20 presumed to be alive. Their families celebrated Adan's return, but called on the U.S. to save all remaining captives in Gaza before it's too late.
Mr. President, sir, all of the Israeli people are behind you. End this war. Bring them all home.
That release came just before Trump made a visit to the Middle East, the first major overseas trip of his second term. The president did not visit Israel or address concerns in Gaza, instead prioritizing economic deals with oil-rich Arab countries during his three-day tour. On his first stop in Saudi Arabia, he met with Syrian President Ahmed el-Shara, a former jihadist who seized power after the collapse of the brutal Assad regime in December. It's the first time leaders from the two nations have met in 25 years. He also made a surprise announcement that he would lift U.S. sanctions on Syria, giving a needed lifeline to a country torn apart by more than a decade of civil war. These efforts to normalize relations with Syria break with decades of U.S. precedent, but a change eagerly welcomed by Syrians who crowded streets and lit fireworks in celebration.
This is a second happiness and a second liberation. The sanctions will be lifted, which means a revival is coming. We will no longer have crises, no more water crisis, no more economic crisis.
Along with numerous other financial deals throughout the trip, Trump also mentioned in Qatar that his administration is nearing a nuclear deal with Iran, though it is unclear whether the U.S. is asking the country to forego its nuclear program entirely. The opulence of the Mideast visits to the wealthy Gulf states highlighted the mega deals that were being announced, with some American billionaires like Elon Musk joining Trump as part of the U.S. entourage. Among other agreements, the U.S. will export billions of dollars of advanced semiconductor chips to the region in exchange for billions of dollars of Gulf wealth being channeled into U.S. companies. Amid those flashy announcements, Trump was also met with intense criticism about a $400 million gift he planned to accept kept from the royal family of Qatar, a 747 luxury jet he said he would use as the new Air Force One. Members of Congress on both sides of the aisle raised immediate concerns about the legality of accepting the jet, the possibility it could be loaded with listening devices, and the nearly $1 billion cost to the American taxpayer to retrofit the plane for security features required to transport America's commander-in-chief.
Well, what I'm concerned is the safety of the president. I mean, Qatar's not, in my opinion, a great ally. I mean, they support Hamas. And so what I'm worried about is the safety of the president of the United States.
Gift, bribe, call it what you want. I imagine the government of Qatar would expect a return on this investment in the president of the United States. So this is ridiculous to think that he could take this airplane.
President Trump brushed aside ethical concerns, saying, quote, only stupid people would reject what he characterized as a free gift. He said the jet would be formally accepted by the Defense Department and transferred to his Presidential Library Foundation when he left office. Therefore, he would never personally own it. That arrangement apparently would bypass a ban in the Constitution against American officials accepting personal gifts from foreign governments. But growing alarm on Capitol Hill spells trouble, because without congressional support, funding to retrofit what's called the Flying Palace will not be approved. On Capitol Hill this week, more than two dozen protesters, including several in wheelchairs, were arrested for civil disobedience after they disrupted a House committee meeting considering cuts to Medicaid. Many more protesters overflowed into the hallway. Lawmakers are trying to find $880 billion in deficit reductions to pay for tax cuts promised by the Trump administration, which are deemed impossible without reductions to federal health funding. The Congressional Budget Office estimates proposed Medicaid cuts could leave more than 8 million Americans uninsured. But on matters usually split down party lines, some Republicans are balking at Medicaid changes they say cut too deeply.
Over 20% of Missourians, including hundreds of thousands of children, are on Medicaid. And Mono, they're not on Medicaid because they want to be. They're on Medicaid because they cannot afford health insurance in the private market. These are working people and their children who need health care. And it's just wrong to go and cut their health care when they're trying to make ends meet, trying to help their kids, trying to make sure that they're able to provide for their families.
Despite objections like Senator Hawley's and a stunning setback on Friday for the budget bill, Republican hardliners concerned about the national debt blocked the massive tax bill over concerns proposed spending cuts in Medicaid are not deep enough. Among other reforms, the Freedom Caucus members are demanding Medicaid work requirements. House Speaker Mike Johnson had wanted a full House vote on the budget by next week. It is now uncertain when the House Budget Committee will have it ready. The debate over birthright citizenship made it to the Supreme Court this week, where justices discussed whether Trump's ban on the provision can be enforced, while the legal battle in the lower courts continues. Hundreds of protesters stood outside the Supreme Court during the oral argument on Thursday. This procedural case does not concern birthright citizenship itself, but whether a federal judge can block Trump's ban from taking effect. After a judge in Washington state placed a nationwide hold on the ban, Trump asked the Supreme Court to step in and allow his administration to enforce the order as it makes its way through the courts. The justices seemed divided over the authority of lower court judges and the role of injunctions.
There are 680 district court judges, and they are dedicated and they are scholarly, and I'm not impugning their motives in any way, but, you know, sometimes they're wrong.
But I think that the question that this case presents is that if one thinks that it's quite clear that the EO is illegal, how does one get to that result in what time frame on your set of rules without the possibility of a nationwide injunction?
The Supreme Court will likely release its opinion this summer. Trump's executive order was blocked before it could be enforced, but the Supreme Court could allow it to take effect. Next, the kickoff of this weekend's National Eucharistic Pilgrimage will tell you all about the St. Catherine Drexel route when we come back. Was a journey like no other. Last year, thousands of Catholics from four corners of the United States embarked on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Pilgrims processed on foot with Christ in the Blessed Sacrament across the country, passing through major cities, walking along scenic trails, and even traveling by boat. As part of the U.S. Bishop's National Eucharistic Revival, the pilgrimage aimed to reignite devotion to the Eucharist. More than 250,000 people participated in the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, many of whom shared incredible stories of healing, peace, and conversion. In gratitude for this outpouring of graces, a new pilgrimage will kick off this weekend and will serve as the grand finale to the bishop's three-year Eucharistic revival. Named after the American saint Catherine Drexel, this new route will begin with a Mass of Thanksgiving in Indianapolis this weekend. Pilgrims will then wind their way through the Midwest and Southwest before they reach their final destination in Los Angeles for the Solemnity of Corpus Christi on June 22nd. Reporter Mark Irons is covering the pilgrimage kickoff this weekend in Indianapolis. He has a look back and a look forward as we preview what's ahead.
2024 brought historic moments for Catholicism in America. The power of Christ in the Eucharist was something witnessed on country streets, in large cities, and along national landmarks. People were moved by the glory of God.
We're a church that needs to go out and evangelize and spread the gospel.
It's us wanting to share this very special, deep, profound relationship we have with Christ, with the world.
It was a reminder that real power is found in a humble source.
We're outside the nation's capital here in Maryland, just one of the many states that pilgrims trekked through last summer with Jesus Christ fully present in the Eucharist. They all converged in Indianapolis for a National Eucharistic Congress. And this summer, the spiritual walk will continue with a journey going from Indianapolis to Los Angeles.
From May 18th through late June, this summer's Eucharistic pilgrimage will crisscross through the American Midwest before traveling down into Texas and Southwest states, New Mexico and Arizona, before arriving in California.
I think anyone that attends, that they're able to be here and witness something so sacred. We're super excited.
Waiting in Riverside, Iowa is Angie Goodwin, youth minister and director of religious education at Holy Family Church. This procession will pass through her town. She knows Jesus Christ and the Blessed Sacrament will bless her community.
I can't wait to have him process down the streets in the community and out into our just local little Iowa farm communities, and have him walk amongst us is just, it just is so meaningful. It's humbling. It's exciting. It's joyful.
Anywhere along the 10-state route, the public can join in the procession or stop for moments of prayer, planned masses and adoration, along with fellowship, meals, and witness talks. Anyone is welcome, each stop unique, with Christ as the focus.
The people we encounter and the people who we want to show who Jesus Christ is in the Eucharist is just extremely exciting.
We heard from young adults joining for the entirety of the pilgrimage who see a great need in society.
If anything, I think this is an invitation for something that the world is hungering, and the Eucharist is our anchor, and the pilgrimage is a public expression of hope.
The procession route is named after St. Catherine Drexel, an American-born saint who served African-American and Native American communities.
She came here when there were, you know, no roads to speak of.
In Arizona, Father Peter Short is pastor at St. Michael's Mission, a historic Catholic presence to the Navajo Nation. Here in 1902, St. Catherine Drexel founded St. Michael Indian School, which still thrives today.
From the school, we had 9 high schoolers baptized. And this year we have 13 that will be baptized in a couple of weeks.
Father Short awaits the pilgrimage passing through in June. He says the work of evangelization continues here.
Pope Francis loved to say that it was important for the church to go to the peripheries. And actually our whole diocese is peripheries. Our whole diocese is reaching out to people that are on the margins. I have a lot of confidence that the Eucharist itself will bring people to Christ.
Father says that includes all people of any background. His thoughts in Arizona echoed back in Iowa.
I get to witness Christ in action every day.
In her line of work, Angie Goodwin sees the impact Christ is having. She says the Eucharistic Lord can transform lives. And young people are among those who are changed.
Like when you see that spark in the kids' eyes when they have those moments, like I get goosebumps like thinking about it. But to have kids come back from experiencing Christ and to hear their witness talks, It's something that's indescribable.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Our EWTN News team will be joining the St. Catherine Drexel pilgrimage route at several points along the way in the next month. Stay with EWTN News in depth for those weekly updates. Among those who will be a witness on the pilgrimage is our own EWTN friar, Father Joseph Mary of the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word. He will join the route in Iowa, where he will be interviewing pilgrims and clergy. We look forward to Father's contribution to our coverage. If you would like to take part in this pilgrimage as it winds through the country from Indianapolis to Los Angeles, it is not too late to register for single events along the way. Go to the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage website at eucharisticpilgrimage.org and look for the city location to find the individual registration link for what you would like to attend. Back to our coverage of Pope Leo XIV's reaction next from the Catholic middle school crowd.
I think it's awesome that somebody from Chicago is now the new pope.
And I think it's good because America represents a lot of different people coming together. So I think he'll really try to make everyone's voice across the world feel heard. And I think that's good as a new pope.
As the first full week of Pope Leo's pontificate comes to a close, we are overwhelmed by stories of the global enthusiasm which has welcomed him. What is very promising for the future of the church is the excitement among young Catholics. Last Saturday, just 2 days after the Holy Father ascended to the chair of St. Peter, we gauged that excitement at an event for Catholic middle school students. Roselle Regis reports.
Really proud that our Holy Father gets to represent our country.
I think Pope Leo XIV is going to do great things for not just America, but for the whole world.
And I really hope that it brings a lot of peace and security to the world, because it's really something we need in this time.
Proud and hopeful, young Catholics were in school when white smoke emerged from the Sistine Chapel chimney, the Vatican signaling the election of a new pope.
And then people started screaming, "The Pope," and everyone was jumping and laughing, and a friend came and hugged me. And it was so beautiful because at that moment, it didn't really matter which sport you played or which friend group you were in or which trend you were following. Everyone was just a young Catholic kid, and everyone was excited that we have a new leader.
It's one thing to celebrate a new pope for the children, but another thing to find out that the new pontiff, Pope Leo XIV, is American and was born in Chicago, Illinois.
Our priest told us that it was Cardinal Prevost from the United States. Everyone just freaked out. Everyone went to a frenzy. It was incredible.
I feel really proud that we have our first American pope and that, like, it feels like we're all united because we were, like, talking about it once we were watching the conclave happening. And we were like, oh, we haven't had an American pope, have we?
I feel like it was such a blessing being able to see this, like, such a historical moment and share it with all my schoolmates.
It is a day they will never forget, especially because they have a special connection to Pope Leo XIV.
I think that having the first American pope is like, it's like a change of pace, it's like new. And that he's also Peruvian too, I'm Peruvian too, so it makes me really happy.
We had Chicago deep dish the day my dad found out. It was great.
I feel like since we have an American pope, he'll understand us more because he's been through what we've been through as Catholics in America.
I think it's nice to have someone who's actually from the USA for once, because they can communicate better.
These middle school students participated in BASH, an annual gathering filled with faith, fellowship, and fun to close out the school year in the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. The students celebrated Mass with Bishop Michael Burbage, who noted the extra enthusiasm among the youth just days after welcoming our new Holy Father.
You see the reactions of the young people from the first moment he was announced. I mean, there's video clips all over of the enthusiasm, and I see it here today at our youth gathering. There is a real excitement because it represents that the Lord has spoken to us.
For these students, Pope Leo XIV is a symbol of hope and peace for America and the world.
I hope that it'll attract more Catholicism, and I hope that more people will become Catholics through that, knowing that he is the first American pope.
I think that it'll make a great impact because he's known around from a lot of places in the world.
I really hope that this new papacy will
be able to expand the Catholic Church and really show Americans that, yes, the Catholic Church is universal and applies to everybody.
Even those involved in youth ministry pray that Pope Leo XIV's papacy will spark a renewal of the young church in America.
Our young people, the Pope seems distant sometimes, and this is so close. He's like I said, he's our homeboy.
Hopefully he brings that youth movement back to the church, which we desperately need for the future of our church.
Marcel Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
And that's this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again same time next week as we continue to report from the Vatican on the new pontificate of Pope Leo XIV and bring you coverage of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage after this weekend's kickoff in Indianapolis. Until we see you again, God bless.